Good afternoon, Tri-State listeners. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And this is Ken, your reader of the Friday, May 22nd, Telegraph Herald from Dubuque, Iowa. We are supported in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation, and we are most grateful for all that they provide and all that our IRIS listeners provide as well. Now we begin at the top of today's fold. Dubuque expects wave of evictions. Thousands of Dubuque residents have lost their jobs because of the coronavirus pandemic, but rent and mortgage payments still are due. And with a state eviction moratorium set to expire next week, city officials are bracing for a wave of evictions. Members of the city's Community Development Advisory Commission this week unanimously approved a program to offer up to $1,000 per month per household for 3 months to assist low and moderate income renters and homeowners whose income has been reduced due to the ongoing pandemic. We do expect an influx of evictions, and we hope this program will benefit both tenant and landlord, City Housing and Community Development Director Alexis Steger said. Some landlords will wait on evictions and sort out state and federal regulations, and some want to keep helping residents by offering payment plans because it's not like the economy is fully open at this point. While state and federal officials have issued temporary bans on eviction, landlords still are filing eviction papers, and without a stronger state and federal response, the U.S. appears headed toward an unprecedented housing crisis, according to data from Princeton University's The Eviction Lab. As people lost their jobs and incomes, about 12% of renters nationwide didn't make their May payments, according to the National Multifamily Housing Council. While landlords have been encouraged to be flexible, waive late fees, and delay rent increases, most operate within thin margins and take out loans to finance their properties, making it difficult for them to absorb an extended break in monthly rent, according to the Housing Council and industry officials. Landlords still must pay taxes, insurance, and staff to maintain their properties. In March, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds issued an emergency proclamation that temporarily suspended evictions for past due rent under state law to help prevent the transmission of infectious disease and help ensure that cases of COVID-19 are properly controlled and treated. Alex Cornia, litigation director for Iowa Legal Aid, stressed that the governor's order does not freeze rent during the pandemic, but delays the inevitable requirement to pay what's been accrued. Reynolds' eviction moratorium is set to expire on Wednesday, May 27th, with City of Dubuque officials anticipating an influx in demand for rental help come June 1st. Additionally, federal funding providing an additional $600 per week to those receiving unemployment insurance benefits is set to expire July 25th. So we will see an additional influx, Steger said. Nearly 25% of all renters in the city spend at least half of their annual income on rent, according to city officials. The commission previously recommended and city council approved using $20,000 out of about $650,000 in federal grant funds the city received for COVID-19 relief to provide short-term rental and mortgage assistance. And city officials anticipate receiving another approximately $500,000 from the state for the program. To qualify for rental and mortgage assistance, applicants must have been working as of January 1st and, as a result of pandemic, either lost unemployment completely or had their monthly income reduced by at least 50%. They must have applied for unemployment benefits and have been current on rent or mortgage payments and all household utilities as of March 1st. They also must meet federal household income requirements. During this week's meeting, Community Development Advisory Commission member Dean Bowles questioned the household income cutoffs and who would be served by the program. He said the income limits were awfully darn low to help very many people. Steger envisioned the program would help college students and recent graduates who have lost or struggled to find work. That didn't get any stimulus checks because they're still on their parents' tax return. They're still trying to make it on their own and can't meet rent, she said. We have a little inset piece on this, and the household size and the maximum income for the program. A household of one, $28,500. Two, $32,600. Three, $36,650. Four, $40,700. Five, $44,000. Six, $47,250. Seven, $50,000. Households of eight people or more should contact program staff. Household income includes current wages, unemployment benefits, child support, military benefits, and Social Security benefits. To apply for the short-term rental mortgage assistance program, call 563-564-7489. That was 563-564-7489. Or you can email go@cityofdubuque.org, or you may visit www.cityofdubuque.org/housing. And our next piece, we have a gentleman working out in a gym, and the caption reads, Joe Magura, 91, exercises at Dubuque Community YMCA YWCA on Thursday. Fitness centers were able to reopen May 15th after being closed for nearly 2 months due to restrictions related to the COVID-19 pandemic. And our article, Gym Patrons Exercise Safety. At 91 years old, Joe Magura realized long ago that working out was key to longevity. Even in the midst of a pandemic, his dedication to fitness remains as strong as ever. Magura was among a small contingent of members lifting weights early Thursday afternoon at Dubuque Community YMCA YWCA. I've got some dumbbells at home, but it's just not the same, he said. You can't get motivated in that environment. When I come in here, it makes me want to work out. Gyms throughout the region were forced to shutter for the better part of 2 months amid COVID-19 restrictions. As they begin to ease, fitness centers are reopening and members slowly are returning to their old ways. The Dubuque Y reopened Monday, with officials overseeing strict safety measures and many members reluctant to return. There has not been an immediate return to normalcy. Officials recorded 77 check-ins Monday and 94 Tuesday, about 15% of the Y's normal average at this time of year. The ones who are coming back are really eager and excited to be here, said Danielle Shea, Director of Marketing and Communications. There are others who are choosing to wait for a while and see how things play out. Piasta, Iowa Community Center reopened its doors May 15th. Executive Director Stacy Bauer said local residents and employees alike eagerly awaited that moment. As employees, we've been seeing it empty for the past 2 months, she said. We hope we never see it like that again. Local officials are cognizant that COVID-19 continues to pose a risk. Moreover, they are aware that fitness centers, which feature sweaty members and shared equipment, could hasten the spread of the virus if safety measures aren't in place. At Piasta Community Center, Cardio equipment has been moved to ensure 6 feet of social distance, and the middle lane of the track has been closed. Even the use of stairways has been altered to ensure that people are moving in the same direction rather than passing each other. At the Dubuque Y, similar measures are in place. The wellness center is limited to 40 patrons at a time, while the weight room is restricted to 10. The gym can be used for pickleball, but basketball is not permitted due to the direct contact involved in the game. Fitness centers in Illinois are 1 week away from taking their first steps toward normalcy. Governor J.B. Pritzker this week announced that gyms can reopen on May 29th. Initially, they will be restricted to one-on-one personal training indoors and groups of 10 or fewer for outdoor classes. In Wisconsin, gym owners have been free to make their own decisions since the state's Supreme Court overturned restrictions established by Governor Tony Evers last week. Anytime Fitness opened its Platteville location on Tuesday with significant restrictions. Club manager Drew Richard said the fitness center is capping its occupancy at 27 people, or 25% of its typical occupancy. "We expected a line out the door when we first opened," Richard said. "So far, I don't think we've been over the 15-person mark any one particular time." Jess Redfern, owner of High Vibe Fitness in Platteville, has chosen to wait until June 1st to reopen her business. "I decided it was best to go with a slower, more cautious approach," she said. Mugera said he wears a mask almost everywhere he goes, but he elected not to wear one during his workouts and said he feels safe. "The equipment is spaced out and people seem aware of keeping their distance," he said. Ed Banstra of Dubuque lifted weights a little more than 6 feet from Mugera on Thursday afternoon. It was his second time visiting the Y since it reopened this week, and the benefits have been immediate. Banstra said he has slept better and his back and neck aches have dissipated. "It's been great to be back, but it does feel pretty empty here," Banstra said. "Over time, it will fill up. It feels like a gradual return to normalcy." And now our final front page piece. We're met by a huge picture. We have three men in white, probably hazard kinds of suits, applying something to what appears to be a boat. Sure enough, here's the caption. "Jose Gueros, Carlos Nunez, and Fabrico Gutierrez apply peel-away paint remover to take the lead paint off the paddle box on the William M. Black Steamboat in the Dubuque Ice Harbor." And our article, "Facelift for William M. Black." And we have another smaller picture of the entire boat. The William M. Black was built in 1934 and was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1982. And our article, "For weeks, workers in masks, face shields, and layered clothing have spent their days aboard the historic William M. Black in Dubuque, gently peeling away at its 86-year-old paint job. It has been a tedious, slow-moving project, but as the paint comes off the boat, the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium's first exhibit gets closer and closer to reopening. The lead paint abatement project on the 277-foot dredge in the ice harbor has been years in the making." "It's been a long process," said Aaron Drogato, the museum's vice president of development. "I am going to celebrate when this is all done, but the actual work doesn't take that long." The museum landed a $66,999 grant from the National Park Service in 2016 for the project. But before the work could begin, Drogato said, museum officials partnered with the City of Dubuque and State Historic Preservation Office to hire the correct people to perform the work while preserving the historic vessel. "There is an overseer to make sure you are doing the project the way you are supposed to be doing the project," she said. "The City of Dubuque is that for us. We need to make sure any materials that we use aren't going to destroy the boat." After years of getting the details in place, Iowa Illinois Taylor Insulation recently started work to remove the lead-based paint and then to give the William M. Black a fresh coat. When it was built, lead paint wasn't thought to be a thing, Drugato said. Not unlike your home, it's not good for you. It wasn't a visitor hazard currently, but we just wanted to make sure when the boat ages, it wasn't going to become a hazard. In September 1979, the steamboat arrived in Dubuque after it was acquired from U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, said Jerry Ensler, President Emeritus of the River Museum. The boat opened to the public the following year. During its heyday, the boat was manned by more than 60 people who worked and slept aboard it. They took it up and down the Missouri River, dredging up and moving sand to deepen the river while also creating beaches, he said. Similar vessels worked on the Mississippi River. It's a time capsule of a different time and era, Ensler said. It is a significant artifact that shows how we as a nation were going to utilize the Mississippi for navigation. Although the boat, which was named after a member of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers who helped build the Panama Canal, does not have a historical connection to Dubuque, it has been in the city for four decades. It is a very significant artifact, Ensler said. For many people, it is their favorite thing about the museum. It's an important, immersive experience. The boat was the museum's first exhibit, and the whole museum for a time. The whole river museum was that, Ensler said. Your river museum was simply to go on the William M. Black. Tremendous things have happened since then. It will open for the season later this month, complete with a fresh coat of paint and ready to mark its 40th anniversary as an open exhibit in Dubuque. I am excited that it will get a new facelift and it will be an attractive artifact for people to explore for future generations, Drugato said. We need to do everything in our power to keep this historic structure alive. It is a major part of history for Dubuque. And now we'll continue with news from Dubuque and the tri-states. At the top of the fold, three new Dubuque County virus deaths. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Thursday's developments included. Three Dubuque County residents confirmed to have COVID-19 died between 5 p.m. Wednesday and 5 p.m. Thursday, according to state figures. The single daily tally was a record for the county. Its total now stands at 14. Neither state nor county officials released any information about the deaths. 13 county residents with COVID-19 were hospitalized as of Wednesday, according to the most recent state data. With four more cases in that 24-hour span, the county also now stands at 300 confirmed cases. That mark is the 14th highest among Iowa's 99 counties. The most cases have been reported in Polk County, 3,342, as of 5 p.m., Woodbury County, 2,412, and Blackhawk County, 1,645. As of Thursday night, the state now is reporting 37 outbreaks at long-term care facilities across the state. Dubuque Specialty Care remains the lone one in Dubuque County, but the state's confirmed case count for the facility on Thursday still was less than the 49 cases that the facility's parent company reported to the TH on Monday. There still are no outbreaks, defined as the three confirmed cases, at any facility in Clayton, Delaware, Jackson, or Jones counties. Statewide, 637 new cases were reported during the 30-hour period from 11 a.m. Wednesday to 5 p.m. Thursday. The state's total stood at 16,170 as of 5 p.m. Thursday. 33 new deaths were reported during that 30-hour window, and total related deaths stood at 414 as of 5 p.m. Note, due to a data error, statewide cases and death totals from 5 p.m. Wednesday were not available for this story. In Wisconsin, there were 472 new cases reported Thursday, pushing the total to 13,885. Six additional deaths were reported, so that total stands at 487. The new cases included two more in Lafayette County and one more each in Crawford and Grant counties. Their respective totals now stand at 18, 25, and 79. In Illinois, the state reported an additional 2,268 cases, along with 87 more related deaths. The state totals now stand at 102,686 cases and 4,607 deaths. Two more cases were reported in Joe Davies County, pushing its total to 25. It marked the fourth consecutive day in which at least one new case was reported. The county's total has increased by 7 in that time. Our next piece, area churches prepare for public masses. Though area Catholic churches are poised to soon reopen for public services, attendance will be limited as parishes follow COVID-19 social distancing guidelines. The Archdiocese of Dubuque recently announced that open to the public masses will resume on Saturday, May 30th, and parishes in the Diocese of Madison can reopen that weekend as well. Parishes in the Diocese of Rockford can gather for Mass starting Monday, May 25th. However, social distancing rules will limit the number of attendees at all Masses for the time being. Masses continue to be offered virtually, and the obligation for those in the Catholic faith to attend Mass will remain lifted. We eventually want all the pews filled and programs well attended. It just might take some time, said Dubuque Archbishop Michael Jekyll in a video message. Prayers for the end of the pandemic's threat, as well as patience and cooperation, are what's needed most right now. Requests for comment from the Archdiocese for this story were unsuccessful. The parishioners in the Archdiocese of Dubuque are kindly asked to understand if Mass is not available locally, should the priest decide that it isn't prudent to reopen on account of his own compromised health situation, or because the coronavirus is still raging in the area, Jekylls said in a statement posted on the Archdiocese's website. A checklist for parishes to go through as they consider how best to reopen to the community also was provided on the Archdiocese of Dubuque website. In the Diocese of Rockford, no more than 10 people will be able to attend Masses, said Penny Wiegert, the diocese's Director of Communication and Publications. Additional Masses might be offered to accommodate more in-person attendees. It's going to look different, Wiegert said. People are used to coming to Mass, chit-chatting, having coffee and donuts. Not anymore. You go to church, then you go home. Brent King, Director of Communications for Diocese of Madison, said parishes were receiving a detailed list Thursday on how to reopen for services. Parishes will be able to hold services at 25% capacity initially. We asked people to be patient, King said. It's going to be different. Both priests and church attendees are encouraged to wear masks in all local parishes. People who are older than 65 or have underlying health conditions are asked to stay home. Attendees of Masses in the Archdiocese of Dubuque and the Diocese of Rockford are asked to receive the Holy Communion with their hands for the time being. Wiegert also said churches in the Diocese of Rockford were asked to remove hymnals and pamphlets from the pews, and any music that is played should be familiar so no one is sharing books. Churches also were asked to empty holy water fonts and deliver holy water to homes if people ask, she added. Things are not going to operate the way they once did, Wiegert said. It's not like someone is going to flip a switch and everything will go back to normal. That would be wonderful, but that's not the reality. Now we'll turn to the opinion page and Our View, the column of quick takes that represents the editorial view of the Telegraph Herald editorial board. And our first smiley, Grassley sticks by his defense of whistleblowers. True to form, U.S. Rep. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican, Iowa, kept up his sterling reputation as the defender of whistleblowers by pushing back against President Donald Trump's recent firing of State Department Inspector General Steve Linnick. The role of Inspector General was created by Congress to combat waste, fraud, and abuse, and to be an independent watchdog holding federal agencies accountable to the taxpayer. Because of that unique role, Inspectors General, Grassley rightly points out, are afforded some protections from political attacks, particularly by the officials they might critique. One of those requirements is that before the removal of an Inspector General, the President must provide an explanation to Congress. That didn't happen in this case, and Grassley wants an explanation. Similarly, Grassley raised questions last month when Trump fired Michael Atkinson, Inspector General of the Intelligence Community. Grassley noted he still has yet to receive a response from the president on that concern. Still, Grassley deserves credit for his consistency, even when the person he's calling out happens to be the leader of his own political party. For decades, Grassley has promoted and defended whistleblowers through legislation and his public statements. President Trump would be wise to listen to Iowa's elder statesman on this one. After all, as Grassley noted in his letter to the president, those who weed out waste, fraud, and abuse are the ultimate swamp drainers. Our next smiley? Today marks the last day that voters can request an absentee ballot for the June 2nd primary in Iowa. And if it's not already in the mail, Dubuque County voters will have to hand-deliver the request to the Election Annex at 75 Locust Street in Dubuque. The county courthouse isn't open. If you already have your absentee ballot in hand, fill it out and mail it in. The primary election is just around the corner. Voters who missed their chance to vote absentee have another option to avoid going to the polls on Election Day. Ballots are now available for in-person early voting. Dubuque County voters should drive to the Locust Street Election Annex between 8 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday, then call 563-587-3870, extension 1980. That was 563-587-3870, extension 1980. Elections staff will help voters cast their ballots without leaving their vehicles. Dubuque County elections officials are encouraging voters to cast their ballots by mail because of social distancing and other requirements prompted by the coronavirus pandemic. You can help protect yourself, others, and poll workers by exercising your right to vote early. Our final smiley piece, a round of applause for the Dubuque County Food Policy Council and its effort to get county residents gardening with a community-wide plant day. Council members put together 1,000 seed kits and made them available for free to families throughout the county interested in growing their own vegetables. Parsley and lettuce kits were passed out this week, and the group made an effort to truly reach throughout the county with pickup sites in Epworth, Piasta, and Farley, as well as Dubuque. Special effort was made to connect with Marshallese residents as well. Parsley and lettuce kits were passed out this week, and the group made an effort to truly reach throughout the county with pickup sites in Epworth, Piasta, and Farley, as well as Dubuque. Special effort was made to connect with the Marshallese again. The gardeners should be visible on social media today with the hashtag DBQ plant today. Since guidelines call for social distancing, it will be a virtual planting session, and families were asked to snap photos or take videos of themselves planting the seeds and to post them on Facebook. Now is a great time for connecting with the outdoors, and reaching children about growing plants and vegetables is a tremendous lesson. Thanks to the Dubuque County Food Policy Council for planting the seeds to grow a new generation of gardeners. I think that's wonderful, having a garden. We've got one ourselves. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap. This is Ken, your reader of today, Friday, May 22nd, Telegraph Herald. And I welcome you all as listeners. And before we turn to the obituaries, we do have one little letter to the editor. And our letter is, "Vote by Mail Push About Politics, Not Safety," from Steve Gritzmacher, West 11th Street, Dubuque. Ben Franklin said, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." We must oppose changing time-tested in-person voting for mail-in voting, collecting on other people's written votes for submission, and allowing mail-in votes screams voter fraud. Other people who collect my vote can accidentally misplace written votes of parties they oppose, written votes that can be opened, reviewed, and tossed. We can use self-serve checkout registers at Walmart and Hy-Vee, but suddenly self-serve voting booths are contaminant risky. They can be disinfected just like Walmart's. This is obviously politics-driven. Our current 250-year-old system works fine. It worked through the polio pandemic, through the Zika virus, H1N1 virus, Spanish flu, the plague, and through World Wars I and II, Vietnam, and Korean Wars. And now we turn to today's obituaries. John E. Tillman of Dubuque was called home peacefully at 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 19th, the day after his 92nd birthday at Dubuque Specialty Care. To celebrate John's life, private family services will be held because of the current gathering restrictions due to COVID-19. A celebration of John's life and Mass of Christian burial will be held at St. Patrick's Church at a later time. Burial will be in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, is in charge of arrangements. John was born on May 18, 1928, in St. Lucas, Iowa, son of Edward and Catherine Kipp Tillman. John was united in marriage to Elizabeth Betty McPoland on November 22, 1956, at the Church of the Nativity, and they were blessed with 55 wonderful years together before she was sadly called home ahead of him June 10, 2012. John devoted 36 years of his working career to the Dubuque Packing Company in the stockyards until his well-earned retirement. He was a faith-filled man who was a longtime member of St. Patrick's Church, where he volunteered his time assisting with the Wednesday night meals for the unemployed. He was also a member of the St. Vincent de Paul Society, the Legion of Mary, where he served as president, the Power of Prayer, and helped out with food donations at the Dubuque Area Labor Harvest. John was all about teaching others the skills he had learned throughout the years and was a longtime Boy Scout leader. When he found some free time, John enjoyed camping, fishing, and heading down to the river to watch the barges lock through. He was also a big NASCAR fan. John was known to occasionally head down to the casino to try his luck at winning the big bucks with family and friends. John was always a people person and enjoyed calling bingo for the residents at Heritage Manor and Dubuque specialty care. Trips to watch the Saints play were always a big hit, and he especially enjoyed watching his great-grandson play hockey with the Dubuque Devils. John also enjoyed a little quiet time, sitting and working crossword puzzles, jigsaw puzzles, and Sudoku. Beyond a doubt, John's family was always his top priority. He loved spending time with them any chance he could. He liked playing cards and enjoyed cribbage, but his favorite was a competitive game of euchre. He even has the broken tables to prove it. We are deeply saddened at losing our father so close to our brother Leo, but take some comfort in the knowledge that they are now happily reunited in heaven with all of our family members who have been called home ahead of us. Memorials may be accepted by the family and can be mailed to Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, Dubuque, Iowa, 52001. Attention, John Tillman family, to be distributed among his favorite charities. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com. Charlotte R. Meyer. Charlotte Rose Meyer, 85, formerly of Apple River, Illinois, passed away Friday, May 15th at Sunset Park Place in Dubuque, with her daughters at her bedside. She was born June 13th, 1934, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the daughter of Andrew and Rose Kunth Parabek. Charlotte graduated from South Division High School in 1952, and in 1955, she received a degree in nursing from Milwaukee County School of Nursing. Charlotte lived in Milwaukee until her marriage to Kenneth Meyer on June 4th, 1955, at St. Marini's Lutheran Church in Milwaukee. She learned to drive and became a passionate dairy farmer alongside her husband. In 1983, she began working at Lafayette Manor Nursing Home in Darlington while continuing to farm. In 1991, she became director of nursing, retiring in 1998. Charlotte was a member of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Warren, Illinois, and the Women of ELCA. She was a past church council member and Women of ELCA officer. Charlotte enjoyed farming, sewing, reading, and playing cards with family and friends. She cherished the time she spent with her family, especially creating memories with her grandchildren. She will be sadly missed and fondly remembered. Due to state and federal guidelines on gathering due to the COVID-19 pandemic, there will be a private family funeral service. It will be held Tuesday, May 26th at 1 p.m., St. Paul's Lutheran Church, 209 Clinton Street in Warren, with Victor Michelle Knight officiating, Vicar. All are welcome to join the processional to Elmwood Cemetery immediately following the service to observe the burial and offer drive-by condolences. The Erickson Funeral Home in Darlington, Wisconsin is serving the family. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at www.ericksonfuneralhome.com. Peter K. Nelson, Reno, Nevada. Peter K. Nelson, 57, of Reno, Nevada, passed away peacefully at his residence May 11th, 2020, as a result of Huntington's disease. He was born October 5th, 1962, in Dubuque, Iowa, the son of Donald K. Nelson and Helen Marie Stewart Nelson. Pete graduated from Hempstead and the University of Iowa. Pete was employed in Atlanta, Georgia for a number of years, returned to Dubuque, and then moved to Reno. Pete was a music lover who was known for his quick wit and his kind, compassionate spirit. Private burial will be at Center Grove Cemetery, Dubuque. Condolences and memories may be shared at www.eaglehoffsiegertcasper.com. Memorials in Pete's name may be made to the University of Iowa Foundation HD Center. Eaglehoff Casper, Siegert Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is entrusted with arrangements. Helen L. McShane, Waterville, Iowa. Helen Chris Lorraine McShane, 87, of Waterville, Iowa, passed away peacefully, surrounded by family on Saturday, May 16th, at Great River Care Center in McGregor, after a short stay. A public visitation will be held Friday, May 22nd, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in McGregor. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, state and federal guidelines on gatherings will be followed. Funeral visitations are considered a mass gathering and limited to 10-person gathering limit. The family would like the visitation open to the public, but with the state gathering limits, we will be implementing a rotation of 10 visitors at a time. A private visitation and service for immediate family only will be held Saturday morning, May 23rd. Burial will take place at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, May 23rd at Smithfield Cemetery, rural Monona, Iowa. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of McGregor, Iowa is assisting the family. Dr. James Egan, Hazel Green. Dr. James Egan, 76, of Hazel Green, died May 20th. Due to COVID-19, private family memorial service will be held at Casey Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City. Private burial will be in Jamestown Cemetery. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Linda W. Osterkamp, Mineral Point, Wisconsin. Linda W. Osterkamp, 75, of Mineral Point, Wisconsin, formerly of Dubuque, passed away Monday, May 18th at Unity Point Health Meritor Hospital. Private family visitation and funeral services will be held Saturday, May 23rd at the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, with Pastor Charles Tharp officiating. Burial will follow at the Bellevue Presbyterian Cemetery in Bellevue. Due to the COVID-19 restrictions, a live stream of the funeral service will be on Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory's Facebook page at 11 a.m. Saturday. Linda was born August 15, 1944, in Independence, Iowa, the daughter of Wayne and Dorothy Gibson Clark. She attended Clark College and graduated with her master's in business administration. On July 28, 1963, she married Melvin Osterkamp. They would later divorce. She was the business manager of the Sears Optical Department in Dubuque. Linda was concerned with women's rights and was a member of NOW. Linda also volunteered with many groups and causes. She helped out at the Ruby Sutton Center with dinners at the Journey Church and with foster children. She had a deep concern for the underprivileged and worked through political causes for their betterment. Later in life, she became a Chicago Bulls fan and enjoyed watching them play with her family. Linda was a very family-oriented, generous, and forgiving individual who touched so many throughout her life. Tyler L. Clower, Potosi, Wisconsin. On Friday, May 15th, 2020, the world lost an amazing husband, father, and son. Tyler Lewis Clower, 28, of Potosi, passed away in a car accident. The love that Tyler had for his wife, family, and friends was unconditional. Everything that he did was for them. He was born the son of Gary and Carrie Hook Clower in Dubuque on May 30th, 1991, and was united in marriage to Paige Reuter on September 3rd, 2017. Together, they had two beautiful children, Reuter and Maverick. He worked at Chick-fil-A Excavating and took pride in providing for his family. Sharing and enjoying his love for outdoors with them was one of Tyler's many passions. Together, they cherished their time by hiking through their woods, riding four-wheelers, hunting for mushrooms, and farming with his father. Tyler's best qualities were his infectious laugh that could brighten any room, his compassionate and vibrant personality, and sarcastic yet sincere humor. He continually made sure that these qualities were instilled in his children. To know him was to love him. A private ceremony will be held on Saturday, May 23rd, 2020, for his immediate family. Following, there will be a celebration of his life at the original Potosi Saloon in Potosi from 12 to 4 p.m. Condolences may be shared at www.optfuneral.com or facebook.com/optfuneral. James D. Metcalf, Piasta. James D. Jim Metcalf, 83, of Piasta, Iowa, died May 20th. A public drive-by viewing will be held from 1 to 5 p.m. on Monday, May 25th, in front of the entrance to the Dubuque County Fairgrounds Ballroom. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the family requests that no one exit their vehicles. Private family funeral services and burial will be Tuesday morning at Dubuque Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are pending at the Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque. John J. Bruno. John Joseph Bruno, 70, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, May 20th at the Unity Point Health Finley Hospital in Dubuque due to COVID-19. Our dear father and grandfather deserves a beautiful tribute. However, in this unknown time with COVID-19 pandemic, having a public visitation is not possible. Please keep the family in your prayers. John was born March 23, 1950, in Waterloo, the son of Robert and Beatrice Bruno. He enjoyed watching the History Channel on TV, eating Carmelo candy bars, and spending time with his grandchildren. Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in charge of the arrangements. Judith L. Isley, Waukon. Judith Lorraine Olson Isley, 78, of Waukon, Iowa, died Tuesday, May 19th at Gunderson Hospital in La Crosse, Wisconsin. A private visitation will be held. A public graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. on Tuesday, May 26th at Lansing Ridge Cemetery, Lansing, Iowa, with Reverend Seder Wembanyama as the officiant. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Lansing, Iowa, is helping the family with arrangements. Daniel Swikert, Monona. Daniel Swikert, 86, of Monona, Iowa, died Wednesday, May 20th at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Arrangements are pending at this time with Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Monona, Iowa. Cards of sympathy can be mailed to Joe Swikert at P.O. Box 216, Monona, Iowa, 52159. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Faith Lutheran Church, Monona, Iowa. This concludes today's obituaries, but we are now going to turn to our new arrivals, those that we always want to welcome in, no matter what things are like out there. They're here, so embrace them with love. And we have several births today. Monday, May 18th, Malone. Tyler and Morgan Malone of Asbury, a girl at Unity Point Health Finley Hospital, Dubuque. Wednesday, May 20th, Cox. Casey and Bria Cox of Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, a boy at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. Heitkamp. Luke and Jocelyn Heitkamp of East Dubuque, Illinois, a girl at Mercy One. Leibold. Brandon and Heather Leibold of Farley, Iowa, a girl at Finley. In Livesay, Will and Jana Livesay of Bellevue, Iowa, a boy at Mercy One. Welcome, all you little ones, to, a wonderful place, and sometimes a rather strange place, but welcome nonetheless. We have several pieces of news in brief throughout, so we'll round out today's reading with those. And the first one is Dubuque Fire Marshal investigating third suspicious fire in 11 days. For the third time in 11 days, authorities are investigating a suspicious fire in Dubuque as a possible arson. Dubuque firefighters responded to 904 Mers Street at about 6:50 a.m. Tuesday, according to Assistant Fire Chief Kevin Esser. They found a small fire in a back room of the residence, which was unoccupied and under renovation. Fire crews extinguished the fire within 4 minutes. It caused an estimated $300 to $500 worth of damage, Esser said. County property records list Michael J. Valpel of Farley, Iowa, as the property owner. However, a Dubuque Police Department incident report lists Braxton's Construction of Dubuque as a victim. Esser said the cause of the fire is undetermined, but deemed suspicious, and it is under investigation. Dubuque authorities last week also were investigating as possible arson fires reported on May 8th and 9th. Police have said the two fires do not appear connected. And Esser said Tuesday's fire does not appear linked to the previous fires. Next one from Dyersville, the Dyersville Relay for Life to go virtual. Dyersville Area Relay for Life will host its annual event virtually this year. Participants can register for the virtual relay at runsignup.com/DyerssvilleRelay5K. They also can purchase luminaries from area banks or throughout the Dyersville Area Relay for Life website. A silent auction will take place from 8 a.m. to midnight Friday, May 29th, and there are other parts of that that you can go look for under Dyersville Relay for Life. Well, I'm just going to cover a little bit of what I think might be a serious piece for some of you who might have children or grandchildren involved. The city is canceling summer leagues. City adult recreation leagues have fallen victim to COVID-19. City of Dubuque Recreation Division Manager Dan Kroger said on Thursday that leisure services adult summer sports programs have been canceled. The decision was made on Wednesday to pull the plug, with organizers of the leagues unable to guarantee the safety of participants and staff from the coronavirus. And I believe a lot of the children's summer activities are also curtailed, but it's not in this article. And we do have a couple of more news and briefs pieces. There's so much in the paper that we're not able to touch on today. But this one is about 875 more unemployment claims were filed in Dubuque County by workers this week that ended Saturday, according to figures obtained by the Greater Dubuque Development Corporation. Nearly 12,200 such claims have been filed in Dubuque County since March 15th, underscoring the massive economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. The most recent week represented an increase over the previous one, when 689 Dubuque County workers filed initial claims. Last week's uptick ended a streak of 5 consecutive weeks in which the totals had fallen. The manufacturing sector easily led the way in new claims with 503, up from 242 in that sector the prior week. There were about 17,500 initial claims filed by Iowa in the week ending Saturday, an increase from 16,735 the previous week. Mirroring local figures, manufacturing led the way with 4,700 new claims. About 2.4 million Americans filed initial jobless claims last week, according to the U.S. Department of Labor. More than 38 million claims have been made nationwide since mid-March. Things are not improving quite yet. And we have one other. State board suspends license of teacher accused of being drunk at work. A former Dubuque Senior High School band director agreed to a license suspension after state officials said he was drunk at work. William Rowley waived his right to a disciplinary hearing and reached a settlement with the Iowa Board of Education examiners, the terms of which were recently approved. Rowley agreed to a minimum 1-year license suspension and accepted a written reprimand. He must take an Ethics for Educators course before his license can be reinstated. Board officials charged Rowley with being on school premises while under the influence of alcohol in violation of Iowa Administrative Code. A board investigation found that on or about November 7th, Rowley was on school premises acting in his official capacity as a teacher and supervising students while under the influence of alcohol. Dubuque Community Schools spokesman Mike Size wrote in an email that Rowley is no longer employed by the district. His last day working with the students was November 7th, and his last day of employment was December 20th. Rowley had worked for the district since 1989. Dubuque school board members in December approved Rowley for the district's early retirement plans, according to board documents. Attempts to reach Rowley for comment Thursday were not successful. Online court records show no criminal charges connected to the incidents. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Friday, May 22nd. I have been Ken, delighted to be your reader today. For IRIS, the Iowa Radio and Reading Information Service for the blind and print handicapped, please remember that DuPaco Community Credit Union, especially the Robert Hafer Foundation, has helped to underwrite our IRIS programs. And don't forget, there's lots more than just the news on IRIS. And until next week, take care out there. Cover up. No matter what is opening up, please, please, please take care. Until next week, so long.